We're going to go now to our feature interview for this week, which is Chris Payne, the director of Revenge of the Electric Car. Good morning and welcome to the Green Majority, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks so much for taking time. We know you've got an extremely busy schedule. It's wonderful to speak to you. I was a huge, huge fan of the first movie. Watched it a couple of times. The story of the EV1, I think, is something that any environmentalist was a tragic film. I think to watch, and I was so excited to see that that you'd done a follow up. Do you want to just maybe just give us a brief overview of the first movie?
Well, you know, I was listening to your international news about the incredible, depressing, you know, weather being changed and the giant toboggan ride to despair that, you know, you can really get on very easily if you take to heart all the stuff that's going on around the planet now. And you know, we made Who Killed the Electric Car was really about how the system that makes money off of all these problems gets in the way of innovation and, you know, makes these problems even worse in the long run. So we made that film. It was really kind of amazing to catch the oil industry and the auto industry in the act of doing this. And the film found a big audience, and I was really happy that we were able to do it. The miracle of the second film is that the first film and people making a lot of noise about what was happening, and, you know, a few other invariables like, you know, the zeitgeist and oil prices, things like this, shifted the world enough so that this technology started coming back. And we were able to get into actually about seven different companies and begin to look at what an industrial revolution or any kind of technical revolution looks like from the inside. And, you know, ultimately we ended up with a people story about overcoming obstacles. And I was just pleased to make a film in which you really feel like we're headed in the right direction for once.
Yeah, I think probably my absolute favorite part of the second movie. I mean, you're very good at creating the narrative. I watch a lot of documentaries, and that's one of the things I enjoy about the films that you've done. Your best character, I'd have to say, in my opinion, from the second film was essentially the Darth Vader character from the first film, which is Bob Lutz. Tell us a little bit about Bob Lutz, the environmentalist within reason.
Well, you know, I was skeptical of the film, this guy, too. He ran basically most of the car companies in Detroit at various points in his career, and also in BMW. He was a major honcho for a while. Bob is not, he's not a believer in human-caused global warming, although I think if you talk to him this week, he might finally be backing down from that. But I thought, my God, if we have an entree into General Motors, we should definitely take it. And Bob, Bob got very competitive because he saw what Tesla was doing with their sports car out here in California, and he said, why are we not doing this? And he went to his board and decided that he wanted to make the last part of his career, his legacy in his 80s as a vice chair, to bring the electric car back. And so when I contacted him and said, hey, you know, would you let us in GM? You can imagine they weren't very excited about having us come film there. But I think Bob's got great instincts, and as you can see from the film, he's like Don Draper or someone from the Mad Men show.
I loved the character in the photo shoot at the beginning there when you were speaking to him, with the cigar and the gruff look, and try to look scary. And he really is just an incredible character. One of the other characters I really enjoyed from the film. There's two other kind of main characters that really, really kind of catch your eye. One of them is Carlos Ghosn, the CEO of Nissan, who has a very almost ominous feel to him when you're speaking to him. He was described as the Napoleon or the warrior, but definitely a big character. The other one, though, that I wanted to ask you about, we've only got a limited amount of time here, so we'll ask people to go and see the film if they want to find out about Carlos Ghosn. But I want to talk to you about Elon Musk. You mentioned Tesla there. I think one of the funniest parts of the film was when they were looking at in the repair garage, and he's freaking out about all the Tesla cars that have problems with them, and he's going on about, we can't have our customers knowing about this or that that's going wrong with the car. I mean, look at this one right here, and it turns out it's your car.
Yeah, my God. We figured that out in the middle of that scene, and Elon like almost turning into a car salesman there, and I'm like, my God, I just found out that my car doesn't work. And he's going to roll it off the line anyway. Of course, that's not quite what happens, but my producer goes, you've got to tell them. And I said, I don't want to be in this film. You know, I don't really like being in my own films. He goes, you've got to say something. So it's just kind of a miracle we're there. And you know, one of the reasons the characters each stand out in their own, we had a terrific music composer, and we picked a score for, you know, Carlos Ghosn at Nissan. It was sort of like the Dr. No score.
Yeah, yeah.
And, Eli, he was sort of the crystal method guy, and we wanted to give everybody kind of a contrasting feeling, so that helps, you know, differentiate them as well.
Absolutely. And so with as far as the end of the film there, this came out 2011. I understand that you just had your UK release. You kind of leave it at the end there with some there's a lot of stories still to tell. One of them is that was about Elon Musk and the Tesla company was still kind of waiting on their they'd just gotten their $90 million loan, I believe, and they were still waiting on the Department of Energy loan for several hundred million dollars. Do you have an update at all on what the status of any of that is?
Oh, yeah. Well, the first thing that happened was there's a lot of political backlash in the U.S. about electric cars. I don't know if backlash is not the right word. It's pretty much inspired from the usual suspects. And Tesla decided not to take a second DOE loan. They did get that loan, and they used it to buy this incredible factory that Toyota had sort of abandoned in Fremont, up in the San Francisco area. They have now, 3 months ahead of schedule, pretty much shocking every industry analyst, started rolling out these Model S sedans, which are half the price of their fancy sports car that we chronicled in the film. And Elon's on a roll. You know, if you watch the Tesla news from day to day, there's like the really positive story, and then someone goes, oh, but there's still trouble ahead. And I think that what he's doing is serving as sort of a catalyst to the whole industry, which is why he made a great central character for us in Revenge of the Electric Car.
Yeah, and people that maybe aren't familiar, maybe they've heard of the Tesla Roadster before, but maybe aren't familiar with Elon Musk. He started PayPal, absolute fortune from that, also involved in the aerospace industry. I love how you describe him as basically the closest thing to a real-life Tony Stark. It was excellent.
Well, that's what the actor who played Tony Stark said. You know, they even filmed one of the scenes in the warehouse for his space company.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, since the movie came out, another thing that Elon pulled off is his rocket ship docked with a space station, which is the first private person with a private company to A, achieve Earth orbit, and B, dock with a space station. So nobody gets in the way of this guy, and that's why it's a terrific kind of entrepreneurial force to have behind electric cars.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in a lot of ways, and I think this is what you were trying to get at with the film a little bit, and by choosing to make him such a central character in the film, was that he is sort of like an indication or like a... it's like an example of almost being able to take the entire industry at all, which is that they've been counted out, and he personally has been counted out so many times on so many projects, and keep like a phoenix seems to somehow rise from the ashes and succeed. So I really love that kind of narrative that you drew with taking him and offsetting him, and there's a piece at the end where him and Bob Lutz are walking around an auto show, and neither of them have seen, or at least Elon hasn't seen pretty much anyone else's cars because he's so been so busy desperately trying to keep his company alive.
yeah, it's true. And, you know, I think, again, to kind of go back to what we were talking about earlier, there's so many pieces of upsetting news about what's going on in the international climate around the environment and around people making a difference in the right direction that I just felt like this is an awesome opportunity to look at some people, even if they don't come out of the environmental, you know, green card checklist or something, that really were trying to turn things around at enormous expense and risk. And that's the kind of energy I think that we need to not just, you know, maybe turn things around depending on what you feel about the future, but to make life more interesting and valuable in the work that we each do individually.
Yeah, and I think that's what was so interesting about the Carlos Ghosn character, the CEO of Nissan, which is that he has something in there where he's not saying that climate change doesn't exist, but he has there's a scene where he's sitting in the car talking about, you know, it doesn't matter whether climate change is real or not. This isn't about Nissan being interested in doing something for the environment. It's that he thinks this will make him rich. Like, he sees an opportunity, and he basically says that customers expect a next generation of electric technology, and he's going to give it to them, and that really has nothing to do with the environment. I think that's very interesting that in a large way that potentially, like, at this point where things sit, you know, yeah, the Leaf stands to be a very successful vehicle, and potentially the least environmentally conscious person of the film potentially may end up being the most successful.
Yeah, isn't that ironic? And I think, you know, his other thing he was after is trying to leapfrog Toyota, because, you know, Toyota's getting very, did a terrific thing with the Prius and making a car that goes 50 miles per gallon, basically. But they were very, very slow in adding a plug to cars. And of course, what a plug allows is once you have a plug on your car, you can't charge it off the roof of your house or your apartment building. It gets you off of oil altogether. It doesn't have to be coal. It can be anything else. So Carlos, by taking the strategy that he's going to be the first to mass market with a plug-in car, really was thinking very strategically and taking a big personal risk.
So from the film, I'm interested in your kind of personal opinion after going through and talking to these, and there's the other gentleman whose name is escaping me at the moment, but whose
Nickname
is Gadget. Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, with seeing some of the kind of startup failures and this sort of thing, and just, you know, hit the disaster that happened to him. I mean, that was just bad luck, basically, or, you know, maybe not bad luck, as they were saying, it was potentially arson that took out his first production area. But do you think that, or do any of these characters in the film, in your opinion, have kind of the right idea? Do you have an indication of which one do you think is going to be the company, or at least the mentality, even if it's not necessarily, you know, GM, but perhaps like, does Bob Lutz have the right idea? Does Carlos Ghosn have the right idea? Which idea is going to have traction, in your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, not to be too banal about it, but they all have the right idea. I mean, Gadget's thing, he was operating without any money. Everybody, you know, we had a billionaire in there. We have a guy who, two people that run big corporations, and Gadget's like my next door neighbor. So when you're not on Olympus and you're like a normal guy working, you're much more sensitive to the ups and downs of what happened in your shop on any given day. And that's kind of what that's his story's about. I think his idea, Gadget's idea, that you've got to take all these gas cars and let's stop building new cars. Let's convert the cars we already have, pull out these heavy engines that burn all this oil, put them aside, melt them down, put in batteries and motors, batteries that can be recycled, motors that are very efficient, very few parts. This is a terrific future for anybody who's a mechanic and cares about the future. I love that, just as sort of the purist mode. And then, you know, Lutz is right that for most people, a pure electric car doesn't have the range. So you've got to throw in a longer range, gasoline backup engine until battery technology, like, kicks more power into, you know, a single charge than 100 miles, for example. And Carlos is right, because you've got a mass market an electric car that costs a little bit less money and doesn't carry around an engine. And Elon's right, because if you don't start at the top, then nobody's going to respect you. And if Elon had started with a golf cart instead of a $100,000 Lotus sports car, I don't think people would give Tesla brand as much credence as they do.
Yeah, and how much, just finally before you go, I mean, we've got the idea there that you're just mentioning about Gadget, about, you know, we've got all these cars already, why do we need to be building new cars?
Yeah.
I, for instance, I had to ride to the, well, not had to, I actually quite enjoyed my bike ride to the radio station this morning. Do you see this idea of the kind of environmentalists pushing and encouraging the idea of electric transportation as a stopgap to kind of reducing just even the idea of one person, one vehicle? Is this a bump on the road to eliminating vehicles in general, or do you think that there's going to be enough car enthusiasts that kind of personal transportation is going to be here to stay for a long time?
Yeah, well, I have a couple more minutes if you want to keep talking.
Sure,
about this,
absolutely.
Because it's a great point. And you riding your bike to work, of course, is the best possible thing that could happen. I mean, this is, we all don't need to have our own car, and this is why ride share is so important, and, you know, getting public transportation, being more efficient, and working at home, and all these things are fantastic, fantastic advances forward. The nice thing about electricity, whether you have a rideshare car or a personal transportation, is that you know, it's a domestic energy. You don't have to, like, bring it in from across the world. And B, it's like, it's so close from where you make it to where you use it, if depending on how you make your electricity. And what the oil companies don't tell you, for example, and we tried desperately to put this in the movie, but it just would make it, I kept making the movie clunky, so I had to take it out, was that the oil industry uses a tremendous amount of electricity to make gasoline. And that's how you get crude oil into, you know, octane 89 or whatever. It just takes a lot of power. If you just took that same amount of power and put it right into the battery of your car, you'd go like 20 miles on a gallon. Mm-hmm. So there's all these economics of efficiency that electricity bring to the equation. And I know that for a while the electric car really got tripped up because some environmental groups said, it's just a different kind of fossil fuel, but it's not. And that's why I think for cars it's such a great step forward.
Well, that was a great point that was made right at the end of the film as well about about how this was it was the only technology that essentially got cleaner the longer you owned it. And I think that's a really important kind of step there, is that these the cars themselves, because they're based on electricity, are essentially, once you've built the car, only as dirty as the energy that's being fed into it. So as we also continue to clean up grids and transfer to renewable energy, that these cars literally do become cleaner as time goes by. And I think that's one of the most important points to kind of make about this technology.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. The older the truck gets on the thing, I mean, this is why I live in Los Angeles and I see super cool looking cats in their 67 Mustang driving by, and I go, that is probably the best looking car on the street here, but it's the biggest polluter because a lot of the gasoline isn't burned. So older gas cars just get dirtier and dirtier.
Yeah, we have. I actually have Ari Rabinovich, my one of my producers, as well in the studio, and him and I went to the Canadian Auto Show, and we actually got to test drive the Nissan Leaf. And Ari, I don't know if you want to jump in here for a second and just, but I mean, I was quite impressed with the Nissan Leaf, actually.
Yeah, it was impressive how it drove. It did feel kind of like a golf cart with leather seats. And I enjoyed the way it drove, and it was really hard to imagine. In the short term, such a vehicle taking over as far as the norm. But I think we do have a little bit of a way to go to make the electric car the commonplace and phase out the combustion engine as the odd man out. But it's definitely a step in the right direction. I think we've come a long way. And I remember when I first saw Who Killed the Electric Car, and there wasn't a single electric car on the road. In fact, the Prius was still a new thing, and people were questioning if it was going to last. So we definitely come a long way, and I think that's where the sequel now comes in. It's like, look how we're doing, and you know we're headed in the right direction.
Yeah. I think one of the things... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Chris.
We bought a... At the end of that movie, I traded in my other cars, and we bought a Leaf and a Volt, and just so that we could have, when we did press over the next year or so, we could have feedback on that car. And my girlfriend loves that Leaf. In fact, we both do. It's a really capable highway car. You're right, it's lighter than your average gas car, although the batteries give it a certain kind of weight. But we've kind of really been impressed by that car. The Volt is a heavier car, and it feels more like a car. Mm-hmm. But I think that the more people that get in and try these things, trying something is a lot more powerful than theorizing about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the impressions, I think Ari would agree with me on this, but one of the impressions we got when we visited the auto show, we were going around, we talked to as many of the CEOs or higher representatives of the various Canadian or the companies that were selling in Canada when we were there. And the impression, I think, Ari, you'll tell me if you agree, but the impression there was that there was definitely a wide range of, commitment. For instance, we spoke to some people. We're not funded by any of them, and neither is the radio station, so I can go ahead and say names. The representative from Ford, for instance, seemed very, very fake about the whole thing. This was definitely them trying to jump on the bandwagon, whereas other companies really impressed us and surprised us with once they learned that we were knowledgeable on the topic. They really they took away their kind of PR talk and immediately started discussing this technology as if they really knew what they were doing. From your opinion, from the research that you've been doing, do you find that a lot of the folks involved in the industry are really committed in the way that Elon Musk is, or are the majority more close to Carlos Ghosn?
Or Bob Lutz. You know, Bob Lutz saw the Volt and the electric car as a marketing thing, is the most powerful aspect of it from a sell point of view for the company. It's like, oh, we're like Toyota. We did something green. Here's our plug-in electric car, and we're only going to make several thousand of them a year. And I think Ford, to a certain extent, a lot of the car companies have been really hedging their bet by saying it's a marketing, by using it as kind of a marketing play in the short term, because they can't make the $3,000 margin they can off of a gas car they've been making for 100 years. So they're kind of going slowly. They don't want to get left too far behind, but they're not. There's a consequence of that is that the cars they are making are usually very high quality because they're making them in sort of limited batches. Mm-hmm. And but Elon's totally committed. Now, admittedly, he's only making 5,000 of these Model S's in this first year. So this is all sort of early times. But the more people that support the car companies, you know, as much as we all hate them on some level, and say, no, this is the kind of car we want you guys making, their boardrooms understand that. And that's why the federal incentives that states and counties are putting in place really help a lot.
Yeah, I'm afraid we're running out of time here, Chris, but I thought a great place to leave it was a quote that I specifically wrote down when I watched it because I absolutely loved it. It's a scene from the movie when Bob Lutz, near the end of the film, is going into a boardroom and they're showing this is after the financial collapse and after GM had to be bailed out. And when they showed their kind of side, you mentioned their kind of like more humiliteous, I'm not even sure what the word would be, the smaller lunches and whatnot. And one of the characters says, there's time for a little humility, and someone else says, if you have not now, when? And I think that's a good statement to kind of leave as far as just the entire environmental kind of idea around, you know, consumption and personal vehicles and cars and transportation, you know, as humanity. I don't think he realized how profound that comment was. You know, it's time for a little humility. If not now, when?
Yeah, and that we filmed that scene practically the day they went bankrupt, and that was like their inner boardroom, and that's the quote they came up with, and it's a great quote for the times we live in. It's a very well said, so I can see why you're the host of that show.
Oh, thanks very much. If there's a third film, can I pitch you on air now? I'll get you on record to say that maybe that should be the title. Time for a little humility. If not now, when?
Good. If not now, when? That might be it.
Sure.
All right, thanks for having me on, guys.
Thank you so much, Chris Payne. And again, the films are excellent. If you didn't catch Who Killed the Electric Car, or perhaps you didn't see Revenge of the Electric Car, go to revengeoftheelectriccar.com. There's some trailers on there, and I actually watched it through Netflix, so we're not funded by them either, but if you have Netflix, you can go ahead and find it on there. Absolutely fantastic, compelling documentary. Thanks very much again to Chris Payne for joining us. Ari, however, we've got 2 or 3 minutes here left. Yeah, about 2 or 3 minutes. And I just wanted to say, you said you were thinking about buying a new vehicle soon. Are you going to be making an electric vehicle?
Yeah, here is the one thing I wanted to comment on regarding that is I'm looking into getting a car soon for work. And I know that Ryan, our technical producer, is also looking into buying a car. And I'm not sure if his thoughts are the same, but In a perfect world, I'd like to be able to invest in something a little greener, ideally the Leaf or some sort of a Prius or any kind of hybrid car. But it's such a paradox because it seems the younger people, like the Generation Yers, are the ones who, you know, are most interested in helping the environment. But we can't afford it on our wages. It's only the upper class that can really afford them because they are considered a premium car. And there's the used ones that come out on the market are still way higher than we're able to afford. So we have no chance of affording anything else except a traditional combustion engine, which are, you know, going way down in value. And that is a good way to look at it in some ways, is that the electric cars have higher value over a long period of time, but the combustion engines, you know, nearly go down by half after the first year or two. So it's a shame that I'm going to have to buy a combustion engine because I really don't have a choice. I do need a car, but I can't afford the hybrid that I want or the electric vehicle that I want. And so I've got to deal with it.
And it's
a shame. There should be some sort of incentive. Ryan,
if I could
anything
add
about
to that?
That
as well, because I've been following, I guess, hybrids and electrics for years, especially after I saw Who Killed the Electric Car. I'm like, okay, this is where it has to go. And it's almost feeling like dealerships are hiding the electric cars. I go in to see the Nissan Leaf, they don't have any. I went to like 15 dealerships across Ontario and none of them keep it in stock. Nobody keeps like the Mitsubishi Electric in stock. It's, oh, you have to do it online and then they'll send you one. So you have to fully commit just to test drive or even touch the vehicle.
Yeah, Tesla Roadster companies had to put, our customers had to put down $50,000 deposits that many of them, after like 2 years of waiting, didn't even know if they were ever going to get it back. So
exactly. Yeah, well, they say it's fully refundable, but
if the company goes bankrupt, then they weren't getting their money back. You know, so, but I think that's a great place to wrap up the show because, hey, if they hadn't killed the EV1 from the first movie, we may have had affordable electric cars now. But no point in trying to play hindsight and remorse on that one.